This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Alex Steffen, one of the world's leading voices on sustainability, social innovation, and planetary futurism. Alex was executive director of WorldChanging.com from 2003 to 2010 and is the author of WorldChanging, A User's Guide for the 21st Century. Alex Steffen is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Carbon Zero, Imagining Cities That Can Save the Planet, published in 2012 and funded by Kickstarter. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you. What led you to write Carbon Zero? What is your goal?
Well, fundamentally, Carbon Zero came out of work that I had been doing already on large global issues, especially climate change and urbanization, and trying to figure out how do we reconcile those two. We live on an increasingly urban planet. We also live on a planet that's in deep crisis. How do we figure out how to make those two things work together? And one of the things that I found very interesting as I started thinking more and more about that was that we already know that there are different ways that a city can be. There are different kinds of systems a city can be made of and different kinds of land use it can base itself on, and that those different choices have profoundly different climate impacts. Sum it up by saying those different impacts can actually be quite large. And if you were to choose the best alternative that we know of from all these different fields and add those together, how good could things get? And my realization was that actually it's entirely possible that we could create cities that essentially have no net climate emissions.
What do you mean by carbon zero? Would you elaborate?
I think one of the challenges when we talk about climate change and greenhouse gas emissions is that, unlike some other things we do, there's no way to be perfect, right? Every human civilization will emit some greenhouse gases that we can imagine. The question is, can you balance the greenhouse gases that civilization emits with what the natural systems with which we are enmeshed are able to absorb and safely handle? So the goal is not to have no emissions, because that's difficult, if not impossible to do. The goal is to have a system in which you have zero net emissions, that when you do all the arithmetic, everything adds up to zero, that you're adding no extra to the atmosphere. And so the best term I could come up with for that was carbon zero.
Would you remind us of why we need zero carbon emissions and how soon?
I imagine anybody listening to this program already understands climate change, understands that it's happening, that it's very serious. Almost all of us, though, have perhaps slightly outdated models of what is actually happening to the climate. We know that the link between greenhouse gas emissions, between rising CO2 in the atmosphere and severe weather, global heating, is very strong. And it's, in fact, stronger than we maybe thought or that we sort of took into account. We're seeing effects that we expected to see many decades from now already happening. Part of that is that there was just a large amount of scientific caution built into our understandings of what different levels of emissions would mean. What we now know is that we used to talk about 2 degrees Celsius being sort of a safe amount that we could afford to heat the planet. And we now know that it's extremely dangerous to go to 2 degrees Celsius, but that we're almost certainly going to go there. Beyond that, we get into not only extremely dangerous, but really catastrophic. And if we were to heat the planet to 4 degrees or more, we'd start to see effects that are literally beyond adaptation, beyond the capacity of our civilization to easily adjust to. So the question really becomes, how do we sort of peek out at the kinds of greenhouse gas concentrations that would lead us to 2 degrees, but then really start pulling back from the brink? That's the survival plan for civilization. And to do that, we need to basically head off our total emissions around 400 or 450 or 500 parts per million, and then start essentially pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere over the long term. That means that there's a very limited amount of greenhouse gases that we can afford to emit. We have been used to talking about these things in terms of percentages. We're going to be 80% better by 2050, but it's not really about percentages. It's about an absolute amount. And we have essentially a budget of the remaining CO2 we can sanely allow to be emitted. And when you look at that budget, it's actually quite small. If my memory serves, it's about 560 gigatons of CO2, which basically means that on any kind of an equitable planet, since there's still an awful lot of construction and development that needs to happen to raise people out of poverty in the developing world, on any kind of an equitable planet, we're going to need to lead the way towards not emitting. Sooner or later, everybody's going to be not emitting. That is a near certainty that at some point here, either because we're forced into it or because we have some foresight, we are going to have zero carbon societies. The question is, how soon do we get there and how much leadership do we take? And I think those of us in the developed world have both a moral obligation and also the capacity to take advantage of an opportunity to really lead the way to having zero carbon cities and from that eventually zero carbon countries.
Would you comment on what you see as the problem with incrementalism in addressing climate change?
Yes. So one of the challenges is because we know that there are large absolute changes that we need to do, it's very different to reduce our emissions by 10% and to zero them out, right? Those are very different goals. And because we have such a short timeline, we have to be thinking now about how to achieve that larger goal. To achieve that larger goal, we need systems change, right? We need to fundamentally change the way we do things like transportation, building and development, growing and delivering food, generating energy, so on and so forth. Our approach for the last decades, really, has been to ask people to make small behavioral changes and to try and get like the low-hanging fruit, the things where we can cheaply or even at a profit improve our environmental performance a little bit. But those things don't actually change the bigger systems. So the problem is that while we work on incremental approaches, we often miss the opportunity to have a deeper commitment to really transforming a system. I'll give you a concrete example. When we talk about American emissions, cars are one of the largest, if not the largest, contributor to the problem. We have a tendency to think that the solution to the problem of planet-destroying cars is to make a better car, a less planet-destroying car, which from a behavioral standpoint makes some sense, and from an incremental standpoint makes a lot of sense, right? Like, I may not feel like I have the power to do much about the world at large, but I can buy an electric car. So we focused on, like, how do we basically build lower emissions vehicles? The challenge, though, is that a lot of the emissions produced by an automotive-dependent society don't actually come out of the tailpipes of the cars. There's a vast network of systems that make that way of life possible, starting with maintaining huge amounts of asphalt for roads and parking. I believe in Seattle, it's something roughly like 40% of the land area is either roads or parking. And that's a huge amount of energy involved in maintaining that whole system. Freeways and highways and tunnels and bridges, the entire infrastructure for selling and repairing and maintaining and disposing of cars, the manufacture of cars, the kind of military expenditures, for example, that we need to maintain in order to maintain our access to oil. There's just a giant amount of our society's activities go into supporting cars. And that doesn't even start to talk about the millions of people who are injured in car accidents every year or killed and the kinds of costs that that extracts on our society in terms of healthcare resources. I mean, I could go on and on. The point being that you can't change most of those things simply by changing the kind of car you drive. You actually have to start imagining an alternative. We know that there are alternatives. We know that, for example, cities that are designed to be more compact, more people-focused, more walkable, have much, much, much lower usage of automobiles, use much less energy for transportation. If you add good transit on top of that, it further lowers the emissions of that area. And we know that it's possible to build lives that are really satisfying, in many ways more satisfying, that hinge on the idea of having access to the things you want close by and having a real sense of community and public space and walkability that make you feel at home in your neighborhood and give you more of the things you need without having to drive all over the place to get them. So if we're serious about tackling, in this example, car emissions and the emissions of the entire system that supports those cars, then we really need to start thinking about how do we provide what people want in a very different way. And that just isn't an incremental process. I mean, that involves land use planning, it involves transportation planning, it involves efforts to acquire park space, to make roads more focused on people and less focused on cars. There are just a huge number of things that have to happen at larger scale levels in order for that to happen. And so I really support anything that somebody feels compelled to do in their own lives to try and limit their impact in the world. It's great that people do that. But I think we need millions of people who are lined up behind the kinds of systems changes that we need to see if we're going to, in fact, not drive over the cliff here on climate.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Alex Steffen, author of the book Carbon Zero, Imagining Cities That Can Save the Planet. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are the key opportunities in cities for reducing carbon emissions? You've been alluding to this, but say more.
The biggest opportunity is simply building cities that are oriented around people and their needs rather than cars and their needs. When you build a city that is denser, that is more walkable, that has more green space and public space, and that has good transit, first of all, you really, really profoundly can drop transportation emissions and very quickly. But you also set in motion some other things that are very useful. One of them is that people who live in more compact communities tend to consume less. And it's not hard to understand why. If you take somebody who makes the same amount of money and you put them in a 900 square foot apartment, and you take a similar person making the same amount of money and you put them in a 3,000 square foot house on the suburban fringe, like, people are going to react differently to that situation. You are very unlikely, for example, to own a home gym if you live in an apartment or condo. Right? You're likely to belong to a gym and to share those facilities with a great many people. If you live way out in the sticks, it might make a lot more sense to have a home gym because it's really difficult to get to the gym. So simply by living in a more compact community, people will tend to have lower emissions on their gym equipment because it's much more effective to have a few machines used by a lot of people than a lot of machines each used by one person. Similarly, many other consumption patterns fall into that, right? Just really obvious reasons. You're less likely to own a lot of furniture. You're less likely to store large amounts of things, et cetera. And so there are real benefits to having truly compact communities. On top of that, if you then take those communities and you look at the buildings that make up the communities themselves, there are a lot of things that we can do to advance the sustainability of those buildings and to lower their emissions. The best thing that I know of is the passive house standard, which is basically an effort to super insulate a home and be conscientious of its siting and its orientation to things like wind and sunshine, such that you can drop the energy use for heating and cooling, and if it's done well, indoor lighting by quite a lot, in some cases up to 90%. And that kind of attention to really making a big systems shift within the building itself can produce really big results. If we had a whole city where every building was aiming for something like passive house standards, there's good evidence to show that we would use a lot less energy. It's a little less pressing of an issue in temperate cities on the West Coast, for example, where we don't get truly hard winters, but it's still a big issue. And it's something where a lot of energy use happens. So if we have compact communities that have better transportation and walkability, where the buildings within those communities are themselves green, and then we add to that sort of an awareness of the kinds of advantages technology is now bringing to urban environments, we gain another possibility, which is simply having much more collaborative approaches to the things we use. I like to talk about capacities and surplus capacities. So the example I frequently use is a home power drill. If you own a power drill, you're probably, like most people, going to use it somewhere between 6 and 20 minutes in its entire lifetime, depending on whose numbers you choose to believe. But that drill, of course, has hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of drilling time that it can do, right? Properly maintained, that drill can be used for a long time. So what we do is we buy these tools that have this enormous capacity to drill, and then we use them for a tiny micro portion of what they can do. If you take that kind of example of a drill and you extrapolate it across society, we live in cities that are giant piles of surplus capacity, right? We live in cities where there are just enormous numbers of things that are going unused at any given time. By using technology that can help us understand not only where we are, that can help us locate ourselves on a map, but understand where other things and other people are, and also like how those things are doing, it gives us the capacity to use them differently. So for example, car sharing. Before we had the digital tools to map the location and availability of cars, car sharing was a really difficult process, right? You had to like write somebody and request a reservation for a car, which makes it very difficult to run like last minute errands. But the minute that you're able to see where all the cars in a given system are and whether or not they are available for the time you want to use them, and to make that reservation on the fly and in a very short term, it means that suddenly all of those cars are not only more accessible to the person who wants to use them, not only do you have more access to driving capacity, but you also can service many more people with a smaller number of vehicles, right? They are used much more efficiently, which means that the impacts of each of those cars goes down quite a bit. And there are people working on these kind of shared capacities in pretty much every field that I can think of. I mean, people are doing it for buildings so that multiple occupants can use the same building more effectively, using it at times when the other occupants aren't. People are doing it for all sorts of things. And if we imagine a city that is already walkable, already built green, and add to it that ability to cap surplus capacities, I think that you end up with a city that is actually functioning quite differently and much more effectively from an emissions reduction standpoint.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Alex Steffen, author of the book Carbon Zero, Imagining Cities That Can Save the Planet. In your book, you speak about clean energy being insufficient to address climate change. Why is switching to clean energy inadequate?
Well, there's a couple reasons. The first reason is that energy demand continues to grow rapidly around the world. Energy demand, though, is not a steady thing or a constant thing. And if we attempt to meet rapidly rising energy demands with clean energy, it means we have to build a lot of it. In order to meet the projected demand for 2050, we would have to not only replace all of the energy now being used on the entire planet with clean energy, but build that much more clean energy again, right? Which is in and of itself an absolutely monumental task, and especially monumental because the best clean energy resources are limited, right? There are only X number of places that have the absolutely best wind power possibilities, the absolutely best solar possibilities, the absolutely best tidal energy or hydro possibilities. And so that in and of itself is just a massive challenge. And it makes a lot more sense to begin to think about how do we reduce demand, because demand is flexible depending on how you design systems. The second problem is that energy is a field that's dominated by some of the largest, most vicious corporations in the world. We have seen over the last 20 years a coordinated, extremely effective, and incredibly well-funded campaign on the part of oil and coal companies primarily to try and convince people that climate change wasn't happening, and now to try and convince people that nothing could be done about it. As part of that, they have maintained a pretty constant attack, political attack, on our ability to site and fund and develop clean energy. So clean energy isn't just like competing in a level marketplace, right? It's competing against very powerful political opponents who have everything to lose by clean energy becoming more widespread. Now, I think that's a fight that we can't shy away from. I think we need lots of clean energy. I think we want to make sure that all the energy our society is using is clean energy. But I am also pretty sure that if we have the idea that we're going to let energy use increase and we're going to try and meet that energy demand with clean supplies, that we will basically destroy the planet before we do that. So what I really think we need to be thinking about is how do we reduce energy demand? How do we reduce energy use by as much as possible? And I think there's lots of evidence to say that there are places where we can change the way that different systems work at the neighborhood level, at the city level, at the individual home level, and not only reduce demand a little bit, but dramatically reduce demand. And if you are able to really seriously reduce demand while providing a similar or better quality of life, then you have the possibility of meeting that much lower demand with clean energy more realistically. So I'm not against clean energy. I just think that any strategy that starts with the idea that that's the main way that we're going to succeed in meeting this climate crisis is doomed to failure.
What role do you see for energy efficiency in reducing carbon emissions?
Well, I think it's critical, and we want to be looking for every opportunity to be efficient. So energy efficiency is generally doing the same thing better. So we have a car that currently gets 40 miles per gallon. We make it more efficient. It gets 50 miles per gallon. Right? We want that wherever we can get it. But at the same time, more important than changing the things we are currently doing to work better is figuring out how to do better things in the first place. An example that I give is air conditioners. When you have an air conditioner, the amount of energy that it's using to cool a room is a certain amount. And you can make that air conditioner perhaps more efficient and use a little bit less energy to cool the room. But behind that air conditioner, you know, the air conditioner is just the tip of an iceberg of energy use and materials use that runs way out into society, right? So there's the entire electrical grid that's connected to that air conditioner, and that electrical grid takes a lot of energy to build and maintain and loses energy in the transmission of power. There's the power plant itself, which in most of America is a coal-fired power plant and is not itself perfectly efficient, right? So it's generating a lot of CO2 and wasting a lot of energy in doing it. Then there's the manufacture of the air conditioner itself. There's the installation of it. There's the maintenance of an entire industry that creates air conditioners and so forth. So the air conditioner itself, even when you make it a little more efficient, is still part and parcel of a huge amount of energy use. But if you can actually take that same room and design it more effectively so that it is perhaps shaded by street trees, that it captures natural breezes, that it uses the cooling effects of the ground, the possibilities of shading at the right times of day, so on and so forth. If you're able to do those things, it's possible to design a room that even in very warm, humid climates can be quite tolerable, and that in more temperate climates, like Seattle or the Bay Area, can be totally livable in the kinds of heats that we get. It's entirely possible to design buildings that don't need air conditioning. When you eliminate the air conditioner altogether, you also eliminate that entire iceberg behind the air conditioner. Because the total cost of, for example, including some better insulation and some more effective windows that can be opened in a building, in energy terms, is really minimal compared to the cost of maintaining year after year after year the ability to deliver energy and use that energy to make a room colder. So wherever we can look at a system and go, is there a way to just simply remake this system so that we aren't using the same kind of energy or aren't doing the same things in the first place? That's where the real wins are. Wherever we can't do that, then yes, we definitely want to look for efficiency. And even within those other systems, we're going to find more opportunities to make them more efficient. But I think that we really need to be looking at ways that we can tackle the systems around us and transform them to be low energy, low emissions, but highly productive and generate a high quality of life.
How would you evaluate Seattle's effort to move toward carbon zero?
In talking about any North American city, we're sort of grading on a curve, right? Because Americans have some of the highest carbon footprints in the world. We're frankly doing the least compared to many other places. That said, I think Seattle would get a mixed report card with some very good grades and some needs work. I think Seattle itself, the people of Seattle, are terrific. There's a lot of brilliant talent, a lot of civic spirit, a lot of people trying to do new things in architecture, planning, technology, energy, etc. I think that the larger effort that's been put forward by the city to try and tackle some of these problems is, compared to many, very foresighted and very smart. That said, I don't think, well, it flat out isn't the kind of plan that will get us to the levels of climate emission reduction that we need in order to survive the crisis that we're in. So the city's plan, as currently put forward, would have Seattle, by a more limited definition, becoming a carbon zero city, essentially, by 2050. But first of all, we need not the more limited. You know, we can't, like, just simply not count things. We need to count everything, right? So we need the broadest possible definitions of what our emissions are. But second of all, and much more importantly, we don't have until 2050. If we were sane, we would be regarding this present moment as something very much like being in total war. The crisis that we're facing is unbelievably urgent and massive. And it is a shame that the city of Seattle in particular, the government, has not really stepped up to acknowledging that, because I think it can. I think Seattle can actually say, well, we know that there is a global carbon budget, and we know that equitably Americans have already used more than their share of it. And we know that for all sorts of other reasons, including rising energy prices and instability, that there's a strong incentive for American cities to step forward and take action. And we also know that cities like Seattle have a lot of talent, and a lot of the people who are going to be making the new way that cities work live there. So it's going to be generating jobs and industry to take this stuff on. And because of all that, you know, it'd be nice to hear the city say, we are going to really push to the farthest end of possibility, right? We're going to do things that we're not sure we even can do yet, because that's where we really need to be. We need to be at the edge of what we even believe is possible. Otherwise, we risk simply failing to respond to the reality of the moment and going past the point where reasonable action can still maintain a stable climate. And I really don't think we need to go there. I think one of the great tragedies of the climate crisis as it's unfolding now is simply that it's so gosh darn unnecessary. There's really very little reason why we need to be melting the ice cap or destroying the Amazon or having rising seas and powerful storms wipe out the city of Hoboken, New Jersey, or have droughts basically cripple Midwest farming, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Wildfires and dust storms blow away half of Australia, right? I mean, these things are totally unnecessary. And it may well be the great tragedy of this time, and possibly a real incrimination of this time, that people look back and go, you know, they had that moment when they could have really changed everything. It was within their reach to do it. And they just simply chose to be less ambitious than that.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think more than anything, it's really that this is the time to aim long. This is the time to think about what is it that each of us as individuals is involved with that relates to systems that generate carbon emissions? And how can we become strong advocates for changing those systems? So in the city of Seattle, that means we really need to think about having a much, much more dense and compact city. It means that we need to think more about things like increasing transit access, that a lot of work needs to be done on creating streets that are people-focused, not car-focused, so that they're walkable, so that anybody anywhere in the city of Seattle can walk to a transit stop, can walk to shopping, can walk to daycare. And also, how do you create a culture where the everyday decisions, things like when somebody's remodeling their home or when a new building's being built or when new technology is being chosen by a company or the city itself, that every one of those decisions is aiming for the edge of what's possible. So that we don't just go, well, this one's a little bit better than the other one, so let's go ahead and get that one. But that we actually start to think, okay, doing a major remodel on a house, how do you make that house something like passive house standards? Really well insulated, really well thought through. How do you choose technologies that are going to enable us to create the sharing of surplus capacity? How do you make infrastructure choices that are going to, over the long haul, right, like over the next decades, deliver much lower levels of emissions rather than just simply confirm the status quo of high levels of emissions? And I think that every single person has the opportunity to weigh in multiple times in a given year on decisions like that. Even when we don't think of ourselves necessarily as like decision makers, we still have input, right? And we still have the opportunity to say, this is a chance for us to think bigger. And the more people that say that, the more people that put that idea out there, the more credible the idea becomes, and the more likely the chance that the people who are the decision makers will start to take seriously those kinds of opportunities and demands. So if I were going to leave listeners with one thing, it would be simply that the fate of what Seattle becomes is basically up to people publicly demanding, people publicly asking that we make the boldest choices we can make every time we're presented a choice.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Alex.
It's really my pleasure. Thank you.
You are just listening to Alex Steffen, author of the book Carbon Zero, Imagining Cities That Can Save the Planet. For more information, check on the web at alexsteffen.com. Again, that's alexsteffen.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.